This is Jude Costello, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona with The Week magazine of February 13th. White House border czar Tom Homan announced that he was pulling 700 immigration agents from Minneapolis and refocusing the enforcement blitz there as Democratic lawmakers demanded Congress place new restrictions on immigration and custom enforcement and other agencies they say have descended into lawlessness. Homan, whom President Trump put in charge of the operation as outrage swelled over the killings of protesters Renee Good and Alex Pretty, cited unprecedented collaboration from local officials who are allowing ICE to take custody of undocumented inmates before they are released from jails. He said there would be a shift away from broad street sweeps to operations focused on immigrants with criminal records. But Homan stressed that Trump was still committed to mass deportations. If you're in the country illegally, he said, you are not off the table. Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey called the reduction a step in the right direction, but noted that with about 2,000 agents still on the ground, it was not de-escalation. Homan's announcement came a day after U.S. citizens who have been shot and violently detained by immigration agents testified at a Capitol Hill forum organized by Democrats. I struggle every day with the pain and the suffering, said Marimar Martinez, 30, a Chicagoan who was shot 5 times by a Border Patrol agent after she tailed the officer's vehicle in her car. Good's brother, Luke Ganger, told the forum that federal agents' aggressive actions are changing the community and changing many lives, including ours, forever. House Democrats released a report slamming agents' unlawful tactics as lawmakers voted to end a partial government shutdown and negotiated over new accountability measures that would be built into a funding package for the Department of Homeland Security. DHS is completely out of control, said Representative Robert Garcia, Democrat of California. Congress has a responsibility to step in. In Portland, Oregon, Mayor Keith Wilson demanded agents leave the city after they lobbed tear gas at demonstrators, including young children, engaging in a peaceful protest outside an ICE facility. In Minnesota, federal judge Patrick Schultz decried ICE's defiance of court orders, saying the agency has ignored at least 96 judicial directives this year. That should give pause to anyone, no matter his or her political beliefs, who cares about the rule of law, wrote the George W. Bush appointee. Tensions in the Twin Cities remain high, said Louis Krause in the Minneapolis Star Tribune, but residents, protesters, and city officials report a seeming change in agents' tactics. They include fewer ICE caravans, fewer agents on foot rousting pedestrians, and fewer confrontations with protesters. But intense fights still break out daily between agents and protesters following them. Videos posted on social media this week showed agents pointing guns at observers, trailing them in an SUV, forcing them out of the vehicle, and detaining them. In neighborhoods once alive with the pulse of immigrant communities, the crackdown has fractured families, rattled worried neighbors, and left residents feeling unsafe, said Ala Elassar in CNN.com. Ryan Strandjord never imagined he'd see his tree-lined, lake-dotted hometown transformed into a battleground by what he likens to a military occupation. U.S. citizens and immigrants alike are choosing to stay home and keep their kids out of school, he said. There's just overall a feeling of fear and dread. Far from de-escalating, ICE is seeking to expand its authority, said Noah Feldman in Bloomberg. The agency has authorized officers to arrest anyone they suspect of being undocumented, even if agents lack a warrant and the person isn't a flight risk. That license for agents to grab just about anyone they want came on the heels of another legally indefensible memo, which said officers could enter homes of suspected undocumented migrants without a judicial warrant. It all reveals an agency bent on making its agents into an all-powerful police force. Judge Schiltz flags another alarming trend, said law professor Ryan Goodman in The New Yorker. The growing lawlessness of an administration engaged in flagrant defiance of court orders. The nearly 100 cases Schiltz cited include repeated instances where the administration has refused orders to release detainees or present them in court or has transferred them to other jurisdictions against direct orders. Their contempt of court is truly extraordinary and may be moving us toward a constitutional crisis. Such actions are unsettling Americans and not just Democrats, said William A. Galston in the Wall Street Journal. More than a third of 2024 Trump voters said in a Politico poll that while they back the president's mass deportation campaign, they disapprove of how it's being done. In a Harvard-Harris poll, majorities said federal agents have gone too far and are violating civil liberties, while a Pew poll found that Americans by wide margins think it unacceptable for agents to stop and question people based on their appearance or the language they speak. Time will tell if the administration's de-escalation talk is sincere or just a cheap PR dodge, said Andrew Egger in The Bulwark. But even if it's the former, these systems now have a logic of their own. Homeland Security has systematically built ICE into something that looks less like a disciplined law enforcement agency than a small paramilitary force recruiting bigoted meatheads with anti-immigrant propaganda and sending them into U.S. cities with minimal training. Once you've created the monster, it won't be easily tamed. U.S. sends armada steaming toward defiant Iran. Iran matched the U.S. military escalation in its backyard with its own provocations, launching a drone at a U.S. carrier in the Arabian Sea and harassing a U.S. oil tanker with gunboats in the Strait of Hormuz. The U.S. shot down the drone and escorted the tanker to safety. Despite the flare-ups, both sides said they were willing to negotiate over a possible deal to limit Iran's nuclear aspirations, though Iran insisted on moving the talks from Turkey to Oman and reducing their scope. The U.S. has sent the USS Abraham Lincoln Carrier Strike Group with over 10 warships and multiple squadrons of fighter jets to the Arabian Sea. Bases in Qatar, the UAE, and Jordan host additional U.S. forces. We have a large armada, flotilla, call it whatever you want, heading toward Iran right now, even larger than what we had in Venezuela, Trump said. If we can work something out, that would be great, and if we can't, probably bad things would happen. Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei countered with his own bellicose rhetoric, saying any U.S. attack would start a regional war, implying that Iranian proxies abroad would target U.S. forces on Middle East bases. Khamenei also described the mass nationwide protests his regime brutally suppressed last month as an attempted coup. Iranian state media said some 3,000 people were killed in the demonstrations, but the U.S. experts estimate the true figure is around 7,000, and Iranian dissidents suggest a toll as high as 30,000. At the peak of the protests, Trump told Iranian demonstrators to stay in the streets, saying help is on its way, but he backtracked after Iran promised to stop the killing. Getting an accurate death toll in Iran is vital, said Scott Anderson in the New York Times. For starters, it's a step in providing a sense of justice for the victims. It's also a morbid way to measure just how concerned Khamenei is about losing his grip on the Iranian people. Across Iran, civilians have reported mass graves, morgues overflowing with body bags, and relatives and neighbors disappearing without a trace. More than 40,000 people were arrested, including children. Clearly, the regime has been shaken by the uprising and fears for its survival. That's why it's unconscionable that Trump lost interest in the protests for a free Iran, said Jim Garrity in National Review. We have an erratic president who veers back and forth between promises of help and threats of force, and then talks up how much he wants to work out a deal. But what is there to talk about? He already claimed to have obliterated Iran's nuclear programs with last year's bombing run. Perhaps it's all a ruse meant to lull the mullahs into a false sense of security ahead of some massive regime change strike. But it just looks like weakness. Regime change is what Iran needs, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. The time to barter with this brutal theocratic government is long past. Trump should not offer sanctions relief in exchange for paper promises about nuclear enrichment concessions, or even in exchange for limits on Iran's missiles or terrorist support. Not that those seem to be on the table. Instead, he must help the protesters topple the Ayatollah and his enforcers. The armada is in place. Use it. Don't assume what comes after the regime's fall will be better, said Harlan Ullman in The Hill. The clerical oligarchy that's in charge now has been a political, social, moral, and economic disaster for Iran, but the Revolutionary Guard, with its fanatical Quds and Basij wings, could even be more tyrannical. Worse, these groups might not be bound by the Islamic dictate that holds that nuclear weapons are sinful and forbidden. If this awful regime could be replaced peacefully and civilly, that would be miraculous. I'm not betting on it. Using force against Iran could actually backfire, said Imran Khalid in Newsweek. By building up its military presence, Washington is providing Khamenei with the bogeyman he needs, and the U.S. may unwittingly be on its way toward hijacking an organic domestic movement for change and turning it into a nationalist war of defense. Restraint, on the other hand, might allow the internal contradictions of the Iranian regime to collapse it organically. Right now, both sides are holding a match over a powder keg, convinced that the other will be the first to blink. In such a scenario, everyone ends up getting burned. It wasn't all bad. A St. Louis neighborhood is thanking a plowing vigilante for voluntarily clearing its streets with a Bobcat construction vehicle he rented out of his own pocket. Kenneth Harrell doesn't live in the neighborhood, but he sprang to the rescue after seeing cars still stuck in the snow days after a recent storm had passed. Harrell took out the machine on his own with no intention of being paid back. It just didn't make sense to me, Harrell said, that people could get out of the house but not off the street. A simple act of kindness on a cold Chicago street made school crossing guard Joe Sass a viral sensation recently. Seventh grader Jose Enrique Rodriguez was nearly at school when he arrived at a crosswalk that was submerged in deep, icy water. Sass approached and asked, "Would it be okay if I pick you up over my shoulder?" The 44-year-old carried the teen past two crosswalks and dropped him off on dry land. Unbeknownst to them, WGN Morning News' Skycam captured the lift and it went viral. Sass's friend created a GoFundMe for him, which has collected over $10,000. Sass said he will give half the money to a local nonprofit and the other half to immigrant-owned businesses. Austin Appleby pulled off an Olympic feat last week when the 13-year-old swam 4 hours to seek help after his family became stranded in shark-infested waters off the coast of Western Australia. Appleby, two younger siblings, and mother Joanne were on a kayak and inflatable paddle boards when strong winds swept them out into the Indian Ocean. To save his family, Appleby swam for 2.5 miles to reach the shore. "I just kept thinking, just keep swimming," Appleby said. Emergency crews rescued his mom and siblings and called the boy's efforts superhuman. Fulton County, a dress rehearsal for election theft? When FBI agents raided an election center in Fulton County, Georgia, carting off 700 boxes of ballots and related documents, some commentators shrugged that it was just another doomed attempt by President Trump to substantiate his big lie of the stolen 2020 election. But the real goal is likely far more nefarious, said Mary Ellen Kloss in Bloomberg. Facing a GOP wipeout in November's midterms, which would end his ability to fend off accountability, Trump is mobilizing the government to find or create evidence of electoral malfeasance in Democratic precincts as a pretext for Republicans taking control of ballots in key states in November. Trump himself confirmed the plan this week, declaring that he wants to nationalize the elections and have the federal government, meaning Republicans, tally ballots in states he deems guilty of electoral corruption. His lackeys are ready to do the dirty work, Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard, Trump's de facto voter fraud czar, was on site for the Fulton raid. By statute, the nation's top spy boss is barred from involvement in domestic law enforcement. But as White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt explained it, Gabbard is committed to ensuring a U.S. election can never, ever be rigged again. Trump will certainly try to tamper with the midterms, said Nick Catoggio in the Dispatch. But to understand last week's raid, we shouldn't discount the president's aggrieved paranoia about Georgia and Fulton County in particular. Bogus tales of shenanigans by black poll workers at Atlanta's State Farm Arena are among Trump's favorite lies to explain his 2020 loss in the Peach State. And it was Fulton's district attorney, Fannie Willis, who later indicted Trump for trying to overturn the election, including by pressuring Georgia's Secretary of State to find 11,780 votes, forcing him through the humiliation of fingerprinting and a mugshot. This raid may have been partly revenge for those indignities, partly preemptive therapy for the right's next painful election defeat. "This is about more than simply keeping Trump happy," said Philip Bump in MS.now. Days before the raid, Attorney General Pam Bondi wrote to Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, suggesting the Trump administration would withdraw ICE agents from his state if he handed over all the state's voter records. Minnesota, one of two dozen mostly Democratic-led states the administration has sued to get their voter rolls, refused the request. Is the big plan to identify and purge Democratic voters or merely to gin up more bogus claims of fraud? We don't know. But the threat to American democracy could not be more villainous if it were spelled out in letters clipped from newspapers and magazines. The president's gambit is working, said Jeet here in The Nation. Even if Gabbard and FBI boss Kash Patel find no crimes in Fulton, and even if Democrats recapture the House in November, Trump will point to stunts like the Georgia raid to justify ignoring congressional oversight. We're facing horrors far worse than that, said David French in the New York Times. The administration is already defying court orders and is already deploying masked agents to terrorize Latino and minority communities. In November, how many minority voters will risk a trip to their polling station? And how many, when they get there, will find they're no longer on the voting rolls? Yes, it's only February, but Trump is stealing the midterms, or trying to, right now, in front of our eyes. It was a good week for candor after government lawyer Julie Lee, asked by a Minnesota judge to explain why ICE and Homeland Security have defied so many court orders lately, expressed her own frustration with the noncompliance and her crushing workload. The system sucks, this job sucks, Lee told the judge. She was removed from her post soon after. It was a good week for Renaissance men after researchers announced that they may have recovered fragments of DNA belonging to artist and polymath Leonardo da Vinci. Extracted from Holy Child, a circa 1510 chalk drawing, the DNA could, if authenticated, settle the authorship of disputed masterpieces. It was a good week for vote rigging after New York Magazine reported that Representative Nancy Mace, Republican of South Carolina, once ordered a staffer to go on Reddit forums about the hottest women in Congress and boost her standing in the rankings. A Mace spokesperson called the allegations ridiculous. It was a bad week for playing soldiers after a man presented to an emergency room in Toulouse, France, with a World War I artillery round lodged in his rectum. After removing the item, surgeons alerted the local bomb squad, who determined that the shell did not present a risk of explosion. It was a bad week for polar bears after Polar Plunge Myrtle Beach, a cold water swimming event to raise funds for the Special Olympics, was canceled due to dangerously cold temperatures. Organizers told the South Carolinians who would have participated to stay home, stay warm, and stay safe. It was a bad week for cybersecurity after Madhu Gautam Ukkala, interim head of the U.S. Cyber Defense Agency, uploaded sensitive contracting documents to a public version of ChatGPT, making the information available to the AI chatbot's more than 700 million users. A spokesperson said the agency remained committed to harnessing AI. Springfield, Ohio. Haitians can stay. A federal judge temporarily blocked the Trump administration from stripping more than 350,000 Haitians of protection from deportation to Haiti, a country gripped by gang violence. In a blistering ruling, Judge Ana Reyes in Washington said Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem had no authority to end temporary protected status for Haitians, first granted after an earthquake in 2010 and set to expire this week. Reyes accused Noem of hostility to non-white immigrants and said Haitians are hardworking people who are here legally and contribute billions to the economy. DHS called Reyes, a Biden appointee, an activist judge and vowed to appeal. Rose Thamar Joseph of the Haitian Support Center in Springfield, a city spotlighted in President Trump's baseless 2024 claim that Haitians were eating people's pets, said the decision was a relief, but noted that the legal fight was not over. "We can breathe for a little bit," she said. Tucson, taken. Authorities intensified their search for the mother of Today Show host Savannah Guthrie, who they believed may have been kidnapped and possibly held for ransom. Nancy Guthrie, 84, disappeared from her home in the Catalina foothills near Tucson, and the gossip site TMZ and CBS's Tucson affiliate both received alleged ransom notes. TMZ said its note demanded a Bitcoin payment. Nancy was last seen entering her home on January 31st. When she wasn't at church the next day, she was reported missing and police found blood splattered on the doorstep and the house in disarray. A security camera was gone, but her phone, wallet, car, and life-saving medications were still there. DNA from the scene has so far not yielded a lead. Nancy has physical ailments limiting her mobility, and Savannah Guthrie pulled out of covering the Winter Olympics for NBC. "We do believe that Nancy was taken from her home against her will," said Pima County Sheriff Chris Nanos, "and that's where we're at." White Plains, New York. Detransitioning. A New York jury awarded $2 million in damages to a woman who underwent gender transition surgery as a teenager that she says left her disfigured for life, the first malpractice verdict over so-called gender-affirming care for minors. Fox Varian, 22, was assigned female at birth but began identifying as male at 15 after struggling with depression and other mental health issues. At 16, Varian had a double mastectomy but later regretted the decision and reverted to identifying as a woman. Varian filed a medical malpractice lawsuit in 2023 against her psychologist and plastic surgeon, saying they coerced her into the procedure without obtaining adequate consent regarding the risks. Meanwhile, the American Society of Plastic Surgeons this week became the first major medical group to oppose gender-related chest, genital, and facial surgery for young people. It recommended such surgeries be delayed until a patient is at least 19. New York City, spared death. A Manhattan federal judge dropped death penalty charges against Luigi Mangione, the 27-year-old accused of killing UnitedHealthcare's CEO on a New York street in 2024. Judge Margaret Garnett dismissed two firearms charges, including one count of using a firearm to commit murder, which carries a potential death sentence. Garnett based her decision on an interpretation of the law that requires that the killing be committed during another crime of violence. Mangione still faces two federal stalking charges, which carry maximum sentences of life in prison without parole, and a state murder charge. Mangione's case has generated a cult-like following among people who believe the CEO's murder was justified by the unfairness of the healthcare system. A Minnesota man, Mark Anderson, impersonated an FBI agent in a failed attempt to spring Mangione from jail. Authorities arrested Anderson, 36, who told jail officers he was in possession of paperwork signed by a judge to free the alleged killer. Paris, X crackdown. French police raided the Paris offices of X and summoned billionaire owner Elon Musk for voluntary questioning in a widening investigation into the social media company. France started examining X last year after suspecting it was tweaking its algorithms to promote racist and other harmful content. Now authorities are also examining sexualized deepfakes and Holocaust denial content generated by X's AI chatbot, Grok. The European Union has also launched a separate investigation of Grok's production of images showing women and children digitally undressed according to users' requests. Musk called the raid on his offices a political attack, and X's Government Affairs Department labeled it an abusive act of law enforcement theater designed to achieve illegitimate political objectives. Havana, anger at U.S. Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel accused the U.S. of trying to suffocate his country after President Trump signed an executive order threatening to raise tariffs on any country exporting oil to the communist-run island. Trump called Cuba an unusual and extraordinary threat to U.S. national security, but later said his administration was starting to talk to its leaders. Trump said Mexico would stop sending oil to Cuba, but Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum denied that and said her government was exploring all diplomatic avenues to continue sending Cuba fuel. Mexico surpassed Venezuela as Cuba's largest oil supplier last year when the U.S. was blockading Venezuela. But Cuba still lacks sufficient supplies and suffers rolling blackouts. London, Epstein fallout. Prime Minister Keir Starmer called for Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, the former prince, to testify to the U.S. Congress about his Epstein ties after newly released photos showed him kneeling over an unidentified woman. And Peter Mandelson, a former British ambassador to the U.S., resigned from the House of Lords and the Labour Party after revelations that he had funneled secret economic information to Epstein and received payments from Epstein totaling $75,000. Mandelson said he didn't remember the payments but didn't want to cause further embarrassment. In Slovakia, meanwhile, National Security Advisor Miroslav Lajcak resigned after it emerged that he'd maintained contact with Epstein after the financier was imprisoned for soliciting a minor. Kyiv, Russia kills the heat. Russia hammered Ukrainian energy facilities with missiles and drones a day after President Trump said President Vladimir Putin had agreed to spare power plants for a week as civilians endure bitter cold. Authorities said it was Russia's worst attack on Ukraine's grid this winter and included 70 missiles and 450 attack drones, several times more firepower than Russia's typical overnight bombing waves. Millions of Ukrainians were left without power as temperatures plunged to -5 degrees Fahrenheit. Kyiv said Russia was weaponizing winter ahead of the next round of peace negotiations. Taking advantage of the coldest days of winter to terrorize people, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said is more important to Russia than turning to diplomacy. Maputo, Mozambique, floods kill. The death toll from flooding in southern Africa rose to more than 100 last week, with another month still to come in the rainy season. Dozens have died across Zimbabwe, South Africa, and Mozambique. At least three people in Mozambique, the worst hit country, were killed by crocodiles that swam into villages from overflowing rivers. Some 400,000 people in the region have been forced to flee their mud brick or adobe homes as the waters rose over the past few weeks. Gaspar Seitfein, director of WaterAid Mozambique, warned that the refugee camps trying to accommodate these displaced people lack good toilets, clean water, and sufficient garbage disposal facilities. For sure, soon we will have cases of cholera, he said. Relief officials are asking donors for $187 million to meet urgent needs. People. Turners on the job training. When Sophie Turner was cast as a lead character in Game of Thrones at 13, her only acting experience was with a children's theater group, said Zoe Williams in The Guardian of the UK. Now 29, she still cringes over her performance in the show's early seasons. I learned how to act on that set, and now I'm thinking, that's not how to do it, she says. It's very embarrassing. Imagine if you were learning to sing and all your lessons had been filmed and broadcast. As the aristocratic Sansa Stark, the British actress was expected to command authority over her co-stars, many of whom were classically trained actors with decades of experience. It was really funny. It felt so foreign and so wrong. Turner was 23 when the show ended in 2019. I didn't know what was up and what was down. I needed to discover who I was. She got on with the business of life quickly, having her first child with her then-husband, pop star Joe Jonas, at 24, and a second at 26. It's really nice, she says, of having kids at a young age. I'm not worrying about my biological clock and all that sort of stuff. At the time, it just felt like the right break to focus on me, nesting and being at home because I'd been a character for so long. Stewart's simmering anger. Kristen Stewart has learned to take Hollywood's sexist attitudes in stride, said Susanna Butler in the Sunday Times of the UK. She was recently talking to a male actor I really love, she says, when she noted that method acting seemed to be a uniquely male phenomenon intended to make acting seem like a feat that it is not. I think acting is just playing pretend, and you don't have to do 50 push-ups before a take. Stewart, 35, says the actor grew defensive and responded that he'd never met an actress that wasn't crazy. A couple of years ago, that would have made me turn red in the face, my ears would have started steaming, and I would have seemed exactly like what he wanted me to seem like, an angry woman. Instead, I continued and got to the end of my thought. Moving behind the camera and becoming a director, her directorial debut, The Chronology of Water, came out last year, has been liberating. Actresses get treated like shit, I've got to tell you. The first time I sat down to talk about my movie as a director, I thought, wow, this is a different experience. They are talking to me like I'm somebody with a brain. When asked about the roots of her feminist fury, though, she doesn't point to her 27 years on camera, but to her family. I mean, I'm a little sister. I have a bunch of brothers. It's effing hell. Kanye West apologized for his long history of anti-Semitism, including his decision last year to sell a swastika-emblazoned T-shirt and release a song titled Heil Hitler, blaming his reckless behavior on a previously undiagnosed brain injury and his debilitating bipolar disorder. In a full-page Wall Street Journal ad titled To Those I've Hurt, the rapper wrote that he fell into a psychotic, paranoid, and impulsive spiral early last year and gravitated toward the most destructive symbol I could find, the swastika. West, 48, insisted he was not a Nazi or an anti-Semite, adding, I love Jewish people. He also wrote he was so sorry to have let down the black community. In recent years, he has suggested slavery was a choice, and worn a T-shirt with the slogan White Lives Matter. West said he was not asking for sympathy or a free pass, though I aspire to earn your forgiveness. Sprinter Sha'Carri Richardson was arrested by Florida police after the Olympic gold medalist was allegedly clocked doing more than 104 miles per hour in a 65 mile per hour zone. Footage obtained by Fox News shows the athlete tearing down a highway near Orlando in her Aston Martin weaving through lanes and flashing her lights at other cars before cutting off an officer who had to accelerate to 110 miles per hour to pull her over. After being stopped, Richardson, 25, pleads with the officer not to take her to jail and blames an underinflated rear tire for her high speed. "I'm a law-abiding citizen, sir," she says. Richardson was arrested last year on domestic violence charges after getting into an argument with her boyfriend, fellow U.S. sprinter Christian Coleman, at an airport. Kim Kardashian enjoyed a romantic getaway in the English countryside with her rumored new beau, Formula One driver Lewis Hamilton, the Sun of the UK reported. Kardashian, 45, and Hamilton, 41, stayed at the exclusive Estelle Manor in the Cotswolds, where a source said they booked a couple's massage and shared a private dinner. "It was all kept very quiet," said the insider. They clearly wanted to have some time for just the two of them. The British race car driver already has the approval of the Kardashian clan, having struck up a friendship a decade ago. Their mother, Kris Jenner, is a fan of Hamilton's, according to the Daily Mail of the UK, and once said he'd make a perfect boyfriend for Kendall. The price of sporting glory. The Milan Cortina Winter Olympics kicked off this week. Will Italy regret playing host? Was Italy ready for the games? Not entirely. But the Winter Olympics are now underway, and over the next 2 weeks, more than 3,500 athletes from 93 countries will compete across 16 sports, ranging from alpine skiing to luge to figure skating. These Olympics are the most geographically spread out of any games in history, with 25 sporting venues and 6 Olympic villages spanning some 8,495 square miles in northern Italy. The two main hubs, the city of Milan and the alpine resort of Cortina di Ampezzo, sit 250 miles apart. Construction delays and cost overruns have plagued the games. Days before the opening ceremony, work was still ongoing at the Sant'Agata Arena, a new $292 million ice hockey venue in Milan. It was originally budgeted at $210 million. Some locals have been angered by the event's environmental cost. Cortina Mayor Gianluca Lorenzi received death threats after centuries-old trees were felled to make way for a $131 million bobsledding track. Lorenzi insists that the project is an added value for Cortina, but history shows that the Olympics often leave behind a legacy of debt, white elephants, and bitterness. How much did these games cost? The Milan Cortina Olympics have an operating budget of about $1.9 billion, which is largely covered by broadcasting and sponsorship deals and sales of tickets and merchandise. But that budget does not include capital costs, including the construction of new Olympic venues or improvements to rail and road systems. The Italian government allocated about $4.2 billion in public money for infrastructure spending. The International Olympic Committee argues that the games pay for themselves by raising a city's profile and attracting tourists, and some reports suggest Milan Cortina could deliver a $6 billion economic boost. But most host cities do not see a positive return on investment. Beijing spent $40 billion on the 2008 Summer Games and generated only $3.6 billion in revenue, while London 2012 spent $18 billion and generated $5.2 billion. For many cities and many countries, said sports economist Robert Bodd, the Olympics are a money-hemorrhaging endeavor. Why are the games so expensive? It's partly because they've expanded to allow more events, more athletes, more venues, and more spectators. but it's also due to each host city wanting their games to be more impressive than the predecessors. One-upmanship, extravagant architectural plans, and a comparatively short construction schedule result in big bills, which are often not reflected in the original bids. An Oxford University study found that from 1960 to 2016, host cities went over budget by an average of 156%. For some games, the cost overrun was far higher. The 2014 Winter Games in Sochi cost Russia at least $30 billion, 289% more than was expected at the time of bidding, and the 1976 Games in Montreal went 720% over projections, leaving the city with a $1.5 billion debt that took almost three decades to pay off. There's this kind of relentless underestimation of costs, said sports historian David Goldblatt, because if anyone knew the real bill at the beginning, they would never sign up. Only one host city has turned a profit in recent decades, Los Angeles. It was the sole bidder for the 1984 Games after the Montreal debacle and insisted that most events be held in existing facilities. L.A. ended up with a surplus of over $200 million on revenues of $619 million. What happens to new infrastructure? Ideally, arenas and other facilities get repurposed when the athletes go home. A 2022 IOC report claims that 85% of venues built for past Olympics remain in use. Rome's Olympic Stadium, built for the 1960 Games, is now home to soccer clubs Roma and Lazio and the colossal National Aquatic Center used in Beijing 2008 is today a popular water park. But many facilities fall into disrepair because they are too expensive to repurpose or are simply not needed. A $38 million aquatics stadium in Rio de Janeiro was left to crumble after the 2016 Games, while Athens is littered with decaying stadiums and pools from the 2004 Games. We've got the ruins of ancient Olympia in Greece, said historian Miles Osgood, but now we've got the ruins of modern Olympia. Is there a more sustainable way? Paris 2024 was promoted as the most sustainable tournament yet. Temporary structures were used to turn historic landmarks into venues. Beach volleyball was played by the Eiffel Tower, judo bouts happened at the Champ du Mar, and existing facilities were refurbished and reused. With a total cost of $10 billion, Paris was the cheapest summer games in a quarter century. But this stripped-back approach is possible only in cities with ample pre-existing infrastructure. It will be very, very unlikely that we will see another city from an emerging economy or one that hasn't hosted the Games already stage a new edition of the Games, said Oxford University economist Alexander Boudzier. The next Summer Games in 2028 will take place in Los Angeles, which was selected after Budapest, Hamburg, Germany, and Rome pulled out of bidding over budget concerns. How is LA faring? Local leaders have pledged not to leave the city saddled with debt. As in 1984, Los Angeles aims to use existing facilities, and officials estimate the total cost of the event will come in at about $7 billion. That figure has swelled 30% since LA secured hosting rights in 2017. But sports economist Andrew Zimbalist said there's still a decent chance that LA is going to break even. But many residents and experts wonder if spending on the games is the best use of resources, with swaths of the city still struggling to rebuild from the devastating 2025 wildfires, an ongoing homelessness crisis, and the city's nearly $1 billion budget deficit. Given what the city and the region now face, said Joel Kotkin, a fellow in urban studies at Chapman University, why would you want to put more stress on it? Best columns of the U.S. Do taxpayers owe Trump $10 billion? Even in a presidential term, drowning in self-dealing, said Paul Waldman of MS.now, the lawsuit President Trump filed against the Internal Revenue Service is so brazen, so shameless, so stunning that it will stand out in history. Trump is suing the IRS for $10 billion because a contractor at the agency leaked documents in 2020 showing that he had paid only $750 in federal income taxes that year. The damages would be paid directly to him and his sons. As head of the executive branch, Trump is essentially both plaintiff and defendant, and his subservient lackeys will no doubt offer him a fat settlement for the disclosure of tax information a presidential candidate should have disclosed himself. Trump has already reaped multi-million dollar settlements through nuisance suits against big media companies, which carried the implicit message, pay me now or I'll use the power of the federal government to punish you. In just the past year, Trump's self-dealing schemes, including his cryptocurrency company, have netted him as much as $3.4 billion. Bound by neither principles nor shame, now he's demanding that American taxpayers open their wallets and give him a payoff of $10 billion. Why? Simply because he can. The high price of vaccine avoidance. A measles outbreak is exploding in South Carolina, said Jonathan Cohn of the Bulwark, and Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. couldn't care less. The state has had nearly 900 reported cases of the infectious disease, the largest outbreak in the U.S. in decades. Measles outbreaks are popping up in pockets where people have low vaccination rates in Florida, Texas, California, and Ohio. Asked if he was concerned about the U.S. losing the elimination status on measles it gained through vaccination in 2000, CDC official Ralph Abraham responded, not really. Under Kennedy, the CDC has promoted the idea that measles is no big deal, but while most children and adults recover after 2 weeks of rashes, high fevers, and misery, the disease can cause complications such as swelling of the brain and pneumonia and can require hospitalization. Before vaccination, about 48,000 Americans were hospitalized with measles every year, with 400 to 500 deaths. Many others suffered the virus's long-term effects, which can include blindness, hearing loss, immune suppression, and seizures. Thanks to Kennedy's crusade to spread vaccine misinformation and fear, an outbreak like the one in South Carolina could very well be coming to a neighborhood near you. Melania, a film about nothing. Amazon's new Melania Trump documentary promised it would reveal the real woman behind the First Lady's steely exterior, said Monica Hesse in the Washington Post. But after sitting through this 104-minute exercise in superficiality, I can report there's nothing to see. Melania, which follows the First Lady as she prepares for Donald Trump's second inauguration, is filled with scenes of the inscrutable ex-model trying on hats, strutting down hallways in stilettos that never come off, and attending meetings about place, settings, and invitations. Director Brett Ratner, exiled from Hollywood after being accused of sexual misconduct by multiple women, never unearths what Melania actually thinks about her return to the White House or anything else. It doesn't matter. Hiding her true personality is, in fact, her personality. Despite its vapidity, Melania took in $7 million in its first weekend, the strongest opening for a documentary in a decade, said Sam Adams in Slate. That would be impressive if Amazon hadn't spent an unprecedented $40 million buying the documentary and another $35 million marketing it. There's an old Hollywood term for a $75 million movie that opens with $7 million in box office, a flop. Melania isn't a documentary, said Alexandra Petri in The Atlantic. It's a horror movie. This is the tale of a woman who experiences none of the things that make life worth living: meaningful conversations, shared laughter, petting a dog, casual interactions with someone who is neither an employee nor a family member. In their place are fittings, more fittings, pomp, private jets, expensively attired billionaires being served, I am not making this up, golden eggs. Melania is trapped in an invisible bubble she will never be able to escape, and she hasn't even noticed. Please don't mistake her for a victim, said Maureen Dowd in the New York Times. The Slovenian Sphinx is not, as some liberals have fantasized, Rapunzel in the tower, pining to be saved from the ogre imprisoning her. She is comfortable with her husband's authoritarianism and comfortable in the frosty vertical solitude of the tower, swaddled in luxury. There is no reason for Melania to exist outside of rank corruption, said Sonny Bunch in The Bulwark. Amazon founder Jeff Bezos spent $40 million buying this hagiography, $28 million of which went to Melania, in the clear hope of protecting his companies from government interference. It's all quite disgusting, but it's also quite fascinating to see just how many Americans will trek to a theater to bask in the golden glow of Trump Tower, and how such a pure and naked instrument of graft and propaganda can be deployed to great effect on an audience happy to lap it up. PACs and campaign committees aligned with President Trump entered 2026 with $389 million in the bank. The Democratic National Committee and aligned House and Senate committees together have $85 million on hand, half the amount they had going into the 2022 midterms, this per the Washington Post. About 10,100 doctoral-trained experts in science and related fields left jobs with the federal government last year. That exodus represents about 14% of all PhDs in science, technology, engineering, math, or health fields employed by the government at the end of 2024, this per science.org. This is Jude Costello, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click On Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.